From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project, folks, is underway, an opportunity for a half hour of analysis and commentary on the media issues of the week. And if we're a little bit lucky, maybe even some insight. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, your host with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. There he is, folks. There he is.
Hi, Rex.
Hi, Alan. And here's Kalen Brown, professor of journalism and head of the communication department at the College of St. Rose. Longtime reporter before that happened, right?
I was a longtime reporter, Rex and Alan. Hello, hello.
And we love having her on the show.
It's a wonderful thing. And I mean that. Alan always tells me when I say it's a wonderful thing that that means that I don't really like something, but it is. It is.
Right,
it's the yes, dear comment.
Yes, dear. Yes, dear.
Yes, dear doesn't mean yes, dear.
That's right. Bless your soul.
Bless your heart. Bless your heart. Yes, yes, absolutely. So one of our regular listeners, John, writes to us who says that he was listening to us on a podcast, and you know, you can always pick up the Media Project at WAMC.org anytime you want it. He says, Alan probably knows how hard it is for me to say this. He is right. So, Alan, you were right about something here. His point here is that traditional journalism isn't trusted because the public can't see journalists as friends and family. He says, Tom Hanks, Denzel Washington, Sandra Bullock, people who literally lie for a living, and that's a cynical view of acting, are the three most trusted people in America. A white man from California, a white woman from Virginia, and a black man from New York. So it's not gender, race, or geography. It is that they can see you and identify, in this case, with your characters, I guess, right?
That's so interesting. I mean, I've said it 1,000 times, Rex, a lot of people like you, but they never knew you before you were on the Media Project. They just thought you were sort of just, you know, a name on the masthead. But we have introduced the world to you, and you owe us,
he says, turning to Kalen. Right.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking about TV broadcasters who have some more face time with their audiences. Over time, TV broadcasters have talked about the fact that they have relationships with their audiences because they see them every day.
Absolutely.
So that seeing them every night, you turn on your 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock news, you do develop some sort of a connection to the people telling you about the world. But that does not negate the value of mainstream print media and online media, where people choose not to be in front of a camera and often generate the more substantive journalism.
Yes, except that our letter writer and Rex are explaining to us that if you don't have this FaceTime with somebody, it's harder for them to respect you.
The subscriber numbers for the New York Times and Washington Post and assorted other reliable sources of information continue to rise and have since this presidency. So I do think that there are a lot of people who do respect the mainstream.
Well, I think she has a point there, Alan.
No, I'm not so sure. I think what we're talking about here is liking the person. It's very hard to like anybody who writes an article, a front page article in the New York Times. You don't know who that person is. Rex and I were fortunate enough to know, and maybe you were, E.J. Dionne, who is one of the top pundits in the United States right now, a mild-mannered man in the tradition of Clark Kent. And he's a wonderful guy. But boy, you don't know that if you're just reading him, unless you know him.
I don't know him, but I know that as a reporter, most of the reporters I've known and me, I didn't care if people liked me. That didn't matter.
I think the point is the credibility factor, and it probably has to do with pundits more than reporters, that if people don't see your face, they just read your analysis, you don't have the automatic credibility that goes to people whose faces, as you say, are in their homes every weekend.
Or the reverse, Rex. I get up very early, as you know, in the morning. I get up at 3 every morning, and then I turn on CNN by 4. And they have a guy on, and it's always a female partner, male and a female partner, and the guy's terrible. I just don't like him. He's brash. He's, you know, he's in your face. Sort of like me.
But you keep turning it on, just like people keep turning on this.
Well, that's all there is. At that hour, that's all there is. And it's the best thing there is on the TV. So if you want to watch what Trump has done the night before or the rest of that stuff, you watch it. Or you do have a choice of going to, once 6 o'clock comes, of going to watch, you know, Andrew Cuomo's brother, Chris Cuomo. And his partner. And so much is so interesting because you can see Maggie Haberman and everybody else on an article, and there's 6 people there, but you don't know how they get along with each other. But if you're watching it on the TV, you say, I don't like the way this is going. I don't like the respect these two people have for each other. And that certainly is the case in this case of the CNN thing that I've been looking at. Well, it's journalism. And journalism, as you know better than anybody, Kaylin, is a matter of messaging. People getting messages. So I remember when Ernie Catro, my old mentor at Channel 6, which was, I was on for years, showed up one day without his wedding ring, which he took off to go into the shower. And he had 20 phone calls. Say, so, you know.
But isn't that a shiny object or the absence of a shiny object? Because that's not what matters. The message is what matters.
You are absolutely such a journalism professor, and you are such a sycophant.
It's absolutely true. It is what matters. And actually, I think it's great that we have both available to people. We have the showbiz aspect of people deciding they trust, or in Alan's case, they don't trust somebody based upon appearances and the sound of their voice, and he just doesn't like the general affect of that guy who you say is too brash in the mornings.
That's
that
right.
Kind of thing. Right. And yet we also have straightforward reporting that relies more on the content, we hope. But it is part of the reason why, probably, the polls show that the credibility of the American media as a, whoops, I just did air quotes on the air. You can't do that. The American media is down, is that people tend to have confidence in people they can see and know, and they don't see and know us. And of course, also, we're being attacked all the time by the White House, so that tends to have an impact on it.
Yes, but, you know, the one trap, we intellectual trap, that we shouldn't fall into is that it's either or. Now, I'd love to know, Maggie Haberman is always, I think, on Morning Joe. She's terrific, from the New York Times. Mm-hmm. So now people have a different perspective about her because she's sedate, she's very bright, and she has dignity. But now you have a feeling of who's got that byline in the paper. I think it's important.
If you happen to watch that show, I never see that show. So, you know, I've seen her a little bit on TV, but I knew of her as a reporter. I knew her work long before that.
Well, because you're an editor. You won the, you know, you were the top of your class at the Columbia Journalism Review, Columbia Journalism School, and all of that stuff.
Boy.
But not, you're not everybody, every man, Rex. I'm talking about more people like me than you, every man. So,
I think I'm an every woman, and I think that Maggie Haberman is an excellent reporter, and I've never seen her, and I trust what she writes.
Mm-hmm. You're also the head of the journalism department, and you're always giving us this stuff about what should be as opposed to what is. And I'm talking about what is, and you're in the what should be category.
What is that I think Maggie Haberman is a good reporter. That's not a should. That's an is.
Hey, come on now. You're not gonna suggest for a single moment I didn't say exactly that 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, but you had to see her first because
I did not. I'm just making the point. Look, Rex is on the show. He's not doing the show for no reason at all.
I'm doing it to try to educate you and keep you from stepping out of line.
And all of us. That's right. And Mike Spain, his deputy, appears with us at least once a week. This is stuff, by the way, that did not go on in the old days. In the old days, it was all competition, you know. It was that the print media felt if it was another place, it wasn't on their plate or whatever. So I think this convergence is a wonderful thing. I do.
I agree with you, Alan.
It isn't either or. It isn't either or.
Well, we're grateful to our listener, John, for provoking this conversation, and we, with great reluctance, turn to another topic, which is the impact on newsrooms in Texas and Louisiana, what's been going on with the disaster there. I have a lot of friends down there because our company, Hearst, owns the newspaper in Houston and the newspaper in Beaumont and a lot of other Texas properties, San Antonio, all of these places. And I have to say, it is just remarkable when you consider what's going on there. Same thing happened after Katrina at places like the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. The impact that has to be felt by these journalists whose own homes are sinking underwater, whose families are having to evacuate, And they're having to go in to work every day to do the job at their place of work.
As, of course, are the cops and the firemen and the EMTs and everybody else there. There was a great article, Rex, perhaps I sent it to you, perhaps not, in the New York Times the other day about the guy who was the resident reporter in Houston. And he got wiped out. Everything he owned.
Cliff Krause. Yeah, he was actually doing his story from upstairs in his house as the bottom floor filled with water. He had reported from 5 war zones, he said. But here he was losing his home, and he and his daughter and wife were evacuating to upstairs.
And everything they have monetarily, you know, the house that they're paying a mortgage on, I expect, and the computers, everything gets eaten up by this water, and you have to do your job.
Well, the reporting is a little bit different, and we've already looked at it in the classroom this week, where there was a woman, a broadcast reporter, who was on air in the torrential rains, and her camera was trained on a tractor trailer that was submerged, and there was a driver inside, and the water was rising, and she flagged down a rescue crew that had a boat with them, and the whole thing unfolded right on camera, where they got their boat off their rack, took it down, and rescued this guy out of a truck where a year ago someone had died in the same place in their truck. This reporter was weeping because she couldn't believe what happened, how she was absolutely involved, which raised a whole question about what are the ethics of in this instance.
Sure, she should have stepped aside, Kayla, and said, let the guy die because it's unprofessional.
She should not have. And another clip of a CNN reporter who was also in a boat going up to a house that was getting filled with water very quickly. He helped pull a very old gentleman out and into the boat with the help of other rescue workers. And he put down his mic, and they just let it run live. And then he picked up his mic after they got this fellow settled in the boat, and he talked about the woman, his wife, who was still inside, and the daughter said there had been trouble because she had Alzheimer's. And he was telling his studio back at home to please be careful and be sensitive, and he used the word delicate because they did not know what state she'd be in because she was suffering from Alzheimer's. And he was shaken. It was extraordinary to watch. And then there was the other CNN clip of the family in one of the rescue shelters. The reporter's name was Flores. And off air, she had asked this mother and who was with her small children, could I talk to you on air? But when the mother started to talk on air, she ripped the reporter, a new one, and said, what are you doing in here asking all of us about how we feel our lives are ruined? And she dropped some F-bombs, and it was upsetting.
It was live?
It was live, and that raised the question of what do we do about live reporting?
Sure, mm-hmm. It raised the question of who loses their license.
Well, yeah. I think that was uncontrollable.
I don't think anybody's going to penalize them for that.
But they won't, but you get one malevolent person, and you never know. As a
Well, and you're right. Trump's. We're talking about CNN, and it's Trump's FCC, and of course the president might try to influence the FCC to do whatever he, who knows?
They don't even have to be told by the president what to do. Yeah. I think people know their marching orders. But I did want to raise with you guys the one story that I saw that really went viral. It's the kind of thing that goes so close to the souls of reporters that there's nothing like it. So the woman is floating along. She's got an infant on her stomach. The woman is dead, and the infant is alive. Mm-hmm. Can't even tell the story.
It was a little toddler with a pink backpack, and the mother had left, and they just rescued them before they were going to go under a canal, and they wouldn't have been able to rescue the toddler either. But I saw that headline, and it talked about the fact that a mother would give up her life for her child. And they were trying to escape. They're not sure where they were trying to go. I think she was in her car. She got stranded, so they pulled out of the car, and that was the result. And it's heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking.
You know, you train reporters. You try to teach reporters to view things with some dispassionate remove. You're supposed to be cool under pressure and keep reporting. But this is impossible in that kind of a situation. And I think actually this goes back to the point you were making earlier about people trusting the credibility of individuals, of journalists whom they view more as human beings rather than simply pass-alongs of information. And this is an opportunity for journalists to actually be involved in a story and be real human beings, even if their camera is going. Be a part of the conversation.
Well, look, you know, I've said it to you guys so many times. You give me a news director on any news station, and you give me a choice of three stories, give them a choice of three stories, that story is going to be the number one story. It has to be, because the three of us have children.
We do.
Would we give up our lives for that child? You bet we would. Yesterday, I was talking to our Joe Donahue. We had a special fundraiser at WAMC.
Remarkable work.
It really was something. Over $320,000. And we just took a day, not even a whole day, to do this. It was really...
To raise money for relief for Harvey.
It really is true. So I, you know, though, that given a choice, that story is going to be the number one story of the mother with the baby. And the three of us, all of whom have children, would give up our lives for our children. We know that, right? Or, they kept saying, for their dog. I asked Joe Donahue, I said, what if they come and say, we can't take the dog, we can only take you? And he says, I stay.
Yeah.
Part of his family.
I can understand that. It is important to recognize that journalism is not just giving people your watchdog reporting on the latest outrages of government or anything else along that kind of hard journalism line that is what we talk about most often in this program, and it's what we really take great pride in our journalism. But an important element of what we do is to give people a sense broadly of what's happening outside their own sphere of influence, of what's going on beyond their view. And that includes giving them stories that help them to feel more fully human. A human interest story helps people to develop empathy. And that's an important part of our life. So I think that a great feature story that gives people a sense of ordinary people's lives, of something beyond their view, is really important. That's why I don't apologize for the kind of reporting that to some people may seem to be opportunistic. When you are saying to somebody in a moment of grief, in effect, how does it feel? You're putting a microphone and a camera or a notebook into the face of someone who's going through a terrible tragedy. What you're doing is you're helping your readers, your listeners, your viewers to understand that depth of human emotion that is important for us to understand.
Well, yes, but the story still has to be accessible. It has to be something that somebody can relate to. When the New York Times is writing stories about monetary values, you know, or economics, you know, you can just see the click-offs. That
it appeals to certain readers and not others.
And because most people don't know about it. I mean, they don't do it. But when you do a story about Melania Trump going down to cover a... let everybody who is listening to the show know that Kaylin is making a face here.
If you start talking about her stilettos on the media project, well, I don't want to talk about her shoes. We have better things to talk about.
No, you see, I don't think so. I think what happens here is it immediately jumps to the top of everybody's interest because it is so accessible. And, you know, in fact, I have a feeling what happened was they saw her with the stilettos. They went on the air. They said she's got the stilettos on going down to a place which is flood ravaged. And when they said that, she came off the plane wearing sneakers.
Is there a journalistic value to the stiletto story?
Yes.
Not for me. There are more important things for us to
you
be working on.
You are such a professor. That's what you do all the time. It drives me nuts.
You're a professor, too, so
yes,
I'm not listening to
you.
Alan, what's the journalistic value there? Go ahead and expose it.
Well, the journalistic value is that you have a president and maybe Mrs. President who don't have their heads on right. And who? And one more
but she looked great, so who cares?
Well, you see, thank God I didn't say that, Kaylin.
I know.
Because if I had said that,
that's right, Alan.
I would be hearing from
wrath
you.
Wrath of.
No question about it.
Yep, double-edged.
And you think that there's no reason for a journalistic outlet to pick up that story?
I think as little attention should be paid to the shoes of the president's wife as possible. I think we have more important things to write about, and thankfully people in Texas, for one, are writing about them.
Well, as the lady always said on Rowan Martin, aren't you special?
My mother told me I am. Yeah.
But that's not the point. The point really is that even the New York Times has the stiletto story up front.
That doesn't mean that it's a good thing. When Marsha Clark had her hair changed 5 times during the O.J. Simpson trial, she was the prosecutor in that case. Every newspaper covered that, including the Times, and they had pictures over the weeks of how her hair changed.
So why was that?
Because they were desperate for news, because it was on TV for the first time. I know, but it's not where the attention should have been paid.
should have, should have. But I'm telling
right,
you now, if you were the editor and you made the choice about the stilettos or you made the choice about the hair color, you would do it because you knew that subject was accessible to your people. You, as the somewhat, no, I risk my whole life here.
Don't go there.
As a somewhat pompous person here, you look down your nose at people who access in that way and say, we should talk about the more important things. Well, yeah, you wouldn't be the news director for more than a day under that circumstance.
Well, Alan's taking a cynical view that this story is getting this sort of play because people are just marketing. But, you know, there is a value to news stories reflecting the reality of what interests people. So I think that the point is that that story, the stilettos deserve a place, a little place, a tiny place, not a significant place. It's not an either or. Hopefully, the stiletto story doesn't overwhelm the important coverage of what's really going on, which we've been discussing on this show.
But you don't think it did, do you? I mean, everybody knew how horrible
this
thing
was. Actually, it took off on social media. And I think that for the mainstream media, for the, let's say, the press that has editors involved and producers, for us to ignore it entirely, it would be for us to be divorced from reality. You have to give some attention to it. You can't just pretend that it didn't exist, that it didn't happen, right?
Well, you know what I love about the Hearst Corporation, your bosses?
I can't wait to hear.
No, I mean it. Is that they do come down somewhere between the cynical view of what you go first with and serious news. I mean, I think that all of their newspapers are fairly serious newspapers. I know yours is, Rex. And that you often don't put things on the front page that everyone else does. And I think, as Caitlin would put it, that's because you don't always believe in bright, shiny lights to distract people with.
Bright, shiny objects. We're not trying to appeal to crows. We're trying to appeal to human beings. And really, our colleagues down at the Houston Chronicle are knocking themselves out. It's quite an amazing thing to see what they're producing. And our colleagues at the Beaumont Enterprise, great friends of ours, and people who are showing up for work every day, notwithstanding the real difficulty of even getting to work. What will probably happen, by the way, is that in a couple of weeks, when their reporters and editors need to be spelled, we'll probably send some people from our newsroom down to help turn out their paper, which is what we did after, you know, in Connecticut,
yeah,
when Sandy Hook happened, and it was very shortly followed by a terrible crash on the Metro North. The newspapers in Fairfield County, which Hearst owns, had back-to-back huge stories that kept them in the newsrooms for 24 hours. So eventually we sent people to help out there. So we'll probably be doing that in the next few weeks. And I suspect that kind of help is going to be needed all over the Southwest.
Sort of like NATO. You know, an attack.
NATO. Yeah, we're just like NATO, no doubt. So it's at times like this that we recognize the importance of journalism in communities, and people are turning for information, in most cases now, to the websites there, because while the Houston Chronicle is turning out a newspaper every day, it is very difficult to get it delivered to all the homes. So a lot of people, this is one of the instances where the digital revolution is really making it possible for us to get the information to people as they need it.
We only have a little bit of time, but years ago, when we first started discussing the digital onslaught here, you predicted, I believe I'm right about this, that someday in the far, far future, there would be no more paper.
Mm-hmm.
No more paper around. Have you changed your mind on that?
No, actually, I've heard experts talk about this, about the decline of paper in our society, saying that by now, I think it would be only decades left, that certainly by a century from now, we probably won't have any use for paper. Because after all, we will have so miniaturized things that we will actually have probably embedded in our bodies access to. I mean, think about it. We already put chips into dogs to track where they are and so on. We'll probably have chips embedded in, and we'll have access points. Perhaps the switch for the chip in my brain to feed me information will be by pulling my right earlobe. And I'll be able to activate the chip that will give me information, and I'll see Alan's face, and it will tell me in my brain, oh, that's Alan Chartok, in case my memory is failing. It'll keep us going for a long time.
That'd be helpful. Yeah. In the classroom, more teachers are assigning e-books, so they are using just digital books instead of actual books. So there's a decline in our offices, not mine personally, but my colleagues have fewer pieces of paper than do I.
And so what about all those guys who come around, you know, and then say, Professor, I'll be in your office. Can I buy your old books from you?
Well, so those were the days, huh?
No, that's still happening. I got that email yesterday.
Yeah,
Ben was around, skulking around, looking. I didn't meet up with him, but the books I have, I generally am using.
Oh, all right. Well, on that, there are some things that still last. And of course, we hope that the journalistic values do, whether paper is there or not. Alan Chartok, Caitlin Brown, and Rex Smith, we are the Media Project. We thank you for joining us and hope we'll see you again next week right here.
The union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such...
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Kalen Brown is the chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained.